With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Everyone here is
greetings and welcome to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage, and here's some tunes to get us started off tonight.
Don't tell me that you knew I
Well, all kinds of things are happening this week in the news, and we're going to talk about cockroaches, soldiers' helmets, robotics, meteorites, a special report on a young girl that is going to amaze you, that's overcoming a disease that a lot of people don't know much about, but is so prevalent in our society today. We really need to get some more education about this. And a few other little things here and there. First up, cockroach brains coming to a pharmacy near you. Insect tissue extracts show antibacterial activity. Cockroaches may be nasty bugs, but they can help fight even nastier ones. New research finds that the rudimentary brains of cockroaches and locusts teem with antimicrobial compounds that slay harmful E. coli and MRSA, the antibiotic-resistant staph bacterium. The work could lead to new compounds for fighting infectious diseases in humans. Extracts of ground-up brain and other nerve tissue from the American cockroach, P. americana, and the desert locust, S. gregaria, killed more than 90% of a type of E. coli that causes meningitis, and also killed methicillin-resistant staph. And microbiologist Simon Lee reported this September 7th at the Society for General Microbiology meeting at the University of Nottingham in England. Some of these insects live in the filthiest places ever known to man, says Naveed Khan, co-author of the new study. These insects crawl on dead tissue, in sewage, in drainage areas. We thought, how do they cope with all the bacteria and parasites? Well, Khan and his colleagues became intrigued by insect antimicrobials when they noticed that many soldiers were returning from the Middle East with unusual infections, yet locusts living in the same areas were unperturbed. So the researchers, all from the University of Nottingham, began investigating how the insects ward off disease. The team ground up various body parts from both cockroaches and locusts that had been reared in the lab and incubated them for 2 hours with different bacteria. Leaving these mixtures overnight on petri dishes revealed that the extracts from brains and from locust thorax nerve tissue killed nearly 100% of the bacteria. Yet the insect brain extracts didn't seem to bother human kidney or epithelial cells when grown with them in the lab dish. Curiously, extracts of insect fat, muscle, and blood didn't bother the bacteria at all. Cockroaches and locusts often eat stuff loaded with microbes, says parasitologist Carl Lowenberger of Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Bay, Canada. So you would think that insect guts and blood, which bathes in the organs, would have similar antimicrobial activity. 9 molecules appear to be responsible for the antimicrobial activity in locust tissue, although they have yet to be identified. The team is also working out the details of the cockroach compounds. Now, these compounds may work together as a cocktail, Lowenberger says. Insects make hundreds of antimicrobial compounds, and it may be that very high concentrations of those molecules which would be required for fighting an infection in humans. But the research is, quote, pretty neat stuff, he says, and perhaps down the road, the yet unidentified molecules will prove useful in fighting infections in people. And continuing with a more brain study, soldiers' helmets could control brain activity with ultrasound. This is from physorg.com. One of DARPA's latest pursuits of cutting-edge research involves a neurotechnology lab at Arizona State University that specializes in ultrasonic brain stimulation. By implementing the technology in soldiers' helmets, DARPA hopes to provide advantages to U.S. troops by enhancing cognitive abilities, improving long-term alertness, and reducing stress, anxiety, and pain. The research lab is run by neuroscientist William Tyler, who has been investigating non-invasive approaches to brain stimulation for many years. Some of the applications of brain stimulation include treating neurological diseases such as Parkinson's and depression, as well as enabling the development of brain-computer interfaces. As Tyler explains in a recent blog post, two of the biggest challenges in brain stimulation are achieving high spatial resolution for precise control of brain circuitry and deep penetration for reaching all parts of the brain. Currently, some brain stimulation techniques require surgically implanting electrodes to achieve these goals, and non-surgical techniques tend to lack in one or both areas. But Tyler has developed a non-invasive technique in which transcranial pulsed ultrasound can remotely stimulate brain circuits without the need for surgery. The pulsed ultrasound can provide a spatial resolution that is about 5 times greater than other non-surgical techniques and can reach deep brain circuits to the same depth as surgical techniques. So, with the new grant from DARPA, the lab is now turning its attention toward developing applications for U.S. soldiers. Instead of using the technology to repair damaged brain circuits, the researchers are now exploring how ultrasound can affect healthy brain circuits. They have developed working and conceptual prototypes of ballistic helmets embedded with ultrasound transducers and microcontroller devices. One of the most important applications may be minimizing the effects of traumatic brain injury, also known as TBI, as Tyler explained to Wired. The really damaging part of TBI isn't the initial injury, he said. It's the metabolic change, the free radicals, and the swelling that are happening in the hours afterward. If you can flick your remote and trigger an immediate intervention, you'd be curbing what might otherwise be a lifelong brain damage. You can see more information on this from, of course, phys.org has links via Armed with Science and Wired. Ooh, and another piece of cool tech news, robotics breakthrough. Scientists make artificial skin. Biotech wizards have engineered electronic skin that can sense touch in a major step toward next-generation robotics and prosthetic limbs. The lab-tested material responds to almost the same pressures as human skin and with the same speed. They reported this in the British journal Nature Materials. Important hurdles remain, but the exploit is an advance toward replacing today's clumsy robots and artificial limbs with smarter, touch-sensitive upgrades, they believe. Humans generally know how to hold a fragile egg without breaking it, said Ali Javy, an associate professor of computer sciences at the University of California at Berkeley, who led one of the research teams. If we ever wanted a robot that could unload the dishes, for example, we'd want to make sure it doesn't break the wine glasses in the process, but we'd also want the robot to grip the stockpot without dropping it. The e-skin, quote-unquote, made by JV's team comprises a matrix of nanowires made of germanium and silicone rolled onto a sticky polyamide film. The team then laid nanoscale transistors on top, followed by a flexible, pressure-sensitive rubber. The prototype, measuring 49 square centimeters, as 7.6 square inches for the Americans, can detect pressure ranging from 0 to 15 kilopascals, comparable to the force used for such daily activities as typing on a keyboard or holding an object. A different approach was taken by a team led by Zenan Bao, a Chinese-born associate professor at Stanford University in California, who has gained a reputation as one of the top women chemists in the United States. Their approach was to use a rubber film that changes thickness due to pressure and employs capacitors integrated into the material to measure the difference. It cannot be stretched, though. Our response time is comparable with human skin. It's very, very fast, within milliseconds or thousands of a second, Bao told AFP. That means that in real terms, we can feel the pressure instantaneously. The achievements are important milestones in artificial intelligence, commented John Boland, a nanoscientist at Trinity College Dublin, Ireland, who hailed in particular the use of low-cost processing components. In the search to substitute the human senses with electronics, good substitutes now exist for sight and sound, but lag for smell and taste. Touch, though, is widely acknowledged to be the biggest obstacle so far. Even routine daily actions such as brushing one's teeth, turning the pages of a newspaper, or dressing a small child would easily defeat today's robots. Bao added important caveats about challenges that are ahead. One is about improving the new sensors. They respond to constant pressure, whereas in human skin, more complex sensations are possible. This is because the pressure-sensing cells in the skin can send different frequencies of signal. For example, when we feel something painful or sharp, the frequency increases, alerting us to the threat. In addition, Bao warned, connecting the artificial skin with the human nerve system will be a very challenging task. ultimately, in the very distant future, we would like to make a skin which performs really like human skin and be able to connect it to nerve cells on the arm and thus restore sensation. Initially, the prototype we envision would be more like a handheld device or maybe a device that connects to other parts of the body that would have skin sensation. The device would generate a pulse that would stimulate other parts of the skin, giving a kind of signal like my artificial hand is touching something, for example. In the future, artificial skin could be studded with sensors that could respond to chemicals, biological agents, temperature, humidity, radioactivity, or pollutants. This would be especially useful in applications where we want to go send robots into environments, including space, where it could be dangerous for humans to go, said Bell. They could collect information and send it back. You can get more information, of course, from the Nature Journal that I mentioned earlier, or you can go to the university websites.
Down to Gonky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change. So close, like brothers. The future's in the air, can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change.
you look at it from up here, you get an appreciation of our world is a beautiful place and we do need to take care of it.
Ooh, here's a story straight from outer space. Meteorite carries remnant of the supernova that created our solar system. The Orgay meteorite crashed into France 150 years ago. It's over 4.5 billion years old, and it might carry a piece of an ancient supernova that was instrumental to the solar system's birth. Since the 1970s, astronomers have hypothesized that a supernova explosion might have released some of the crucial materials needed to form our sun. This ancient star would, in essence, be the father of our current star. The existence of such a supernova would help explain why certain elements, such as chromium-54, are unevenly distributed throughout the current solar system. The chemical compositions of extremely ancient meteorites, like the Orgay rock, carry certain microscopic records of the supernova's own chemical makeup, and so they can help reveal what this ancient supernova was really like. Two short-lived isotopes, aluminum-26 and iron-60, were found inside the Orgay rock and are strong indicators of supernova origins. In particular, they likely came from a type 2 supernova, which is when a massive star collapses and explodes. It's also possible our sun's quote-unquote father was a type 1a supernova, where a white dwarf star in a binary system becomes overstuffed and explodes. Further tests of the meteorite should reveal which kind of supernova preceded the birth of our solar system. Cosmochemists are particularly interested in measuring the levels of calcium-48 in the Orgay meteorite. Calcium-48 is extremely common in type 1a supernovas, but almost unheard of in type 2 supernovas. The analysis of calcium-48 should reveal which sort of supernova helped create our solar system, which basically means we're conducting the cosmic equivalent to a paternity test. You can find out more about this in Astrophysical Journal. Now here's a story that could actually affect you right now while you're sitting there looking at the computer. Short-sightedness gene discovery could consign glasses to history. British researchers teamed up with colleagues around the world to pinpoint variations in DNA that make people more susceptible to myopia, which is the most common sight problem. The breakthrough could lead to treatment in the next decade with eye drops or tablets that halt the distorted growth of the eyeball, which causes the condition. Short-sightedness is a relatively new but growing phenomena, and as urbanization and intensive education levels increase, is reaching epidemic proportions in some parts of the world. Around a third of the people in Britain are short-sighted, but in the Far East is an even bigger problem, possibly because of the use of technology at an early age is more prevalent there. In Japan, two-thirds of the teenagers are already myopic, and in Singapore, 80% of 18-year-old male army recruits are short-sighted, compared with just 25% 30 years ago. Now, while watching television, reading, staying indoors is obviously having an effect, researchers knew that there was also a strong hereditary or genetic element as to whether or not you succumbed. In a study involving thousands of people around the world, including 4,300 in Britain, they searched for genes associated with degrees of myopia. They found that a number of variations around the RASGRF1 gene, which is associated with eye growth, seemed to be strongly associated with myopia, either preventing it or protecting against it. Researchers now hope to be able to identify how exactly they affect the growth of the eye and then develop treatments that produce the perfect mix of genes. In this way, they should be able to prevent the eyeball distorting and therefore maintain 20/20 vision in most of the population. It is not quite the end of the glasses yet, but clearly the hope is that we will be able to block the genetic pathways that cause short-sightedness, said Dr. Christopher Hammond at King's College London, an eye surgeon who led the British research. Now, it will probably take the form of a tablet or eye drops, but it's going to be a challenge, and at least 10 years before there is actually a treatment. Most people are born long-sighted, and in the past would develop normal vision as they grow up at about the age of 8. However, we spend much of our youth staring at screens and books, and the eye appears to overcompensate and continue growing, causing permanent short-sightedness. Myopia happens when the focal point of an image falls just short of the retina at the rear of the eye, causing blurred distance vision. While many cases of myopia are mild, about 2 or 3% are pathological cases with retinal detachment, premature glaucoma, and glaucoma leading to eventual blindness. The lead author, Professor Terry Young at Duke University, North Carolina, said that the eye was a great subject for gene repair. The eye is already an organ of choice for gene therapy, for example, because of the eye's small volume and self-contained area that allow the therapy to remain inside the eye in a concentrated volume, he said. In addition, the eye's accessibility lets clinicians observe the effects of treatment over time with non-invasive methods that can illuminate and test the retina and other eye structures. In the meantime, before the treatment is effected, scientists recommend that children get outside more, as this allows the eye to focus on more distant objects, and it is thought that sunlight also helps maintain healthy sight. The findings published in Nature Genetics will not be relevant to age-related long-sightedness, as this is to do with the eye muscle's ability to focus and not to do with the distortion of the eyeball itself. Reading glasses will still be needed for a while. Meanwhile, a sister study has found the gene mutation that causes glaucoma, which is, of course, the world's leading cause of blindness. The breakthrough could lead to earlier detection and treatment of a condition that affects 67 million people worldwide, including 600,000 in the UK. But only half are diagnosed as patients, are often not aware of symptoms until a great deal of useful sight has been permanently destroyed. The variant is on a section of DNA known as a chromosome, called 7q31, and is common among Europeans, with about 6% carrying two copies, putting them at 60% more risk of developing the chronic degenerative disease than those who carry none. It's also estimated that if just 10% of glaucoma cases in the UK were detected and treated earlier, it could save up to £1 billion a year. Now, if diagnosed in time, the condition could be easily treated with just eye drops. The condition causes damage to the optic nerve, which carries visual information from the eye to the brain. Imagine how many people this research could affect, and it could affect you, your children, your children's children. Oh, it's a great research breakthrough.
Sinner and the color of God. grin and a sad man grin. I heard an honest man lie. Good side of bad and the downside of up and everything between. I licked the silver spoon, drank from the golden cup to the finest. Baddest dimes at least a couple of times before I broke their heart. You know where it ends, yo, it usually depends on where you start. Stacks out on the corner with you. You like to hang out late, you like getting faced and keeping pace with thugs. Until late one night, there was a big fight and Max lost his head. He pulled out his talks and wound up dead. Now his wife and his kids are torn to bits of all of his pain. You know, it comes that way, at least that's what they say when you play the game. Up to hear the news, then you really might know what it's like to have to lose. Yeah, then you really might know what it's like.
What is it like? This next story is about a young girl who has been dealing with a disease that is commonly associated with drug users and sexually transmitted disease. She has chronicled her life on film, and you can find it on YouTube, uploaded through Media Online. And here is her story that I found in telegraph.co.uk by Cassandra Jardine. Now, this was uploaded about, oh, a year ago or so, and it impacted me a great deal. This young lady has made it her mission to demystify what it's like to live with hepatitis C. And here's her story. It girl Jazzy DeLisser, 17, breaks taboos on hepatitis C. Since birth, 17-year-old Jazzy DeLisser has suffered from the insidious virus hepatitis C, which attacks the liver and often leads to cirrhosis. In order to change people's perceptions and raise awareness of the disease, she has made an award-winning film about her life and the debilitating treatment she went through. Already at the age of 17, Jazzy DeLisser is used to being described as one of London's it girls. Gorgeous, wealthy, and well-connected, she has every ingredient for the role. Her best friend, Coco Sumner, is Sting's daughter. Her stepfather is former racing driver Johnny Dumfries, now the Marquess of Bute. She lives with her mother, Serena, and various whole, half, and step-siblings in the kind of pared-down Notting Hill splendor that shouts, cool. But behind the gilded externals of her life, Jazzy has a secret so devastating that she hasn't yet talked about it with many of her friends. When she was 6, and word got out that she had hepatitis C, an infectious blood-borne virus that attacks the liver, she says, "People wouldn't let their children come play with me or come to our house. I'm nervous about how others will react when they know I have a disease they associate with drug users." Maids are bustling about the Bute's steel and pale wood kitchen, while Serena Bute, who designs clothes under the label Anonymous, supervises preparation of organic asparagus and artichokes for supper. Healthy eating is a religion in this household, where both mother and daughter need to care for their livers. Jazzy, who is wearing the standard teen uniform of summer dress and biker boots accessorized with friendship bracelets, sips at a cloudy health drink to help her get over the side effects of her recent treatment for the hepatitis. Her long blonde hair, which this winter fell out in handfuls, is slowly growing back, she says, patting the reassuring little tufty bits. The eczema and rages she suffered from are now mostly gone, though she still is unnaturally tired. The night before we met, Jazzy confessed to Serena that she felt nervous about speaking publicly about her illness, but she's over those nerves now, talking with a quiet resolution that shows unusual maturity. Retreat is not an option, since she has already made huge strides to raise awareness of hepatitis C, an illness that affects an estimated 466,000 people in Britain, many of whom don't know they have it until they're age 30 to 50, and their livers show the signs of damage that lead to cirrhosis and cancer. Over the past 2 years, while studying at 4A levels, Jazzy has set up a charity, made an award-winning film, and commissioned another. Her latest incarnation is a party planner raising funds to support research into liver disease, the fifth biggest cause of death in Britain. It started with the film, she explains, curled up at the end of the leather sofa in her parents' sitting room under huge old film posters. I wanted to make a video of the diary of the treatment because I had never met anyone of my own age with the virus. It was a lonely thing. I couldn't talk about it to my friends. No one my age seems to know anything about the liver. They don't even know where it is. I want to help other people understand, but sometimes, she falters, it's so hard to press on. Her film, My Story of C, takes as its starting point October 2007 when Jazzy, then 15, decides that the time has come to beat the virus with help of Professor Georgiana Miley-Vergani, a pediatric hepatologist, which is a liver specialist, at King's College Hospital in London. Three viruses, A, B, and C, are responsible for most cases of hepatitis, Professor Miley-Vergani says. A is caught from contaminated food and drink, although the effects are dramatic. Sufferers go yellow, and it passes. B and C are the dangerous ones. In 30% of the cases, the hepatitis leads to cancer or severe scarring, which is also called cirrhosis, which causes the liver to harden, change shape, and not function properly. Of the two, B is much more infectious and highly heritable, but there is a very effective vaccine against hepatitis B that is used in most civilized countries, but not in Britain. There is no vaccine against hepatitis C, so it is spreading fast. The World Health Organization estimates that 170 million people around the globe may have hepatitis C. The treatment prescribed for Jazzy consisted of two drugs, ribavirin to prevent the virus from multiplying, and interferon to boost her immune system so it could kill off the virus. As she embarks on the weekly injections and blood tests, we see her being told by Professor Miley-Vergani that the chances of success are 40%. It's enough to give her hope that by the end of it, she will be able to party, have boyfriends, and one day children without the threat of damaging herself or passing on the virus. Jazzy needs to cling to the hope, because she tells the camera at weekly intervals, the drugs make her feel so weak and give her such crippling headaches that she often can't get out of bed. Some days I would just wake up feeling furious and take it out on anyone around, usually my mother. It was really hard on my family. At the time she had a boyfriend, but not now. It's difficult knowing at what stage to tell boys. I worry because there's a lot of risk at passing it on, no matter how rare, and I don't like talking about it. During treatment, she tried to lead as normal a life as possible, skipping neither school nor parties. It was difficult because I wasn't allowed any alcohol. At my age, people really get off their faces. I had to learn to be with them and not lose my confidence. The whole experience changed me. When I look at the early parts of the film now, I look so shy and nervous. The film, which has now just won the Media's Trust competition for short films by 15 to 19-year-olds, is unflinchingly honest. It shows Serena accompanying Jazzy to hospital appointments, her brother Joshua chiding her for staying out late, and her 9-year-old sister Lola for being understanding about Jazzy's grumpiness. There's jubilation when, 3 months gone into the treatment, she is told that it has worked and the virus is gone. The despair is when, after another blood test, she hears that it's returned. It ends in January 2009 with Jazzy receiving the painful news that there's no point continuing because the virus is not responding. All she can do is wait for better drug to become available. Even a liver transplant will not help, as the virus would infect the new liver. Watching Jazzy's film, Professor Miley-Vergani was deeply moved. Even though I have been treating her since she was 3, I cried. She says she watched the hope die in this young girl's eyes, and she is not the only one. It's all real. I'm not an actress, Jazzy says. The hardest part was at the end when she told me it hadn't worked. I wanted them to turn off the camera and throw the film away. I was really upset. But I realized after a while that I was no worse off than before I started. If I can't fix it or change it, I've got to live with it. Afterwards, it became more important to make the film so that some good would have come of the treatment. What the film doesn't explain is why Jazzy contracted hepatitis C in the first place, only that she acquired it from her mother. That story begins with the early 1980s, long before Jazzy was born. Joining Jazzy on the sofa, Serena Butte is in tears as she explains the guilt she feels because her own youthful folly has blighted her daughter's life. Serena Wendell arrived in London age 18 straight from a sheltered childhood in Wales that revolved around ponies and boarding school. With her English rose look, she soon found herself in the world of modeling and glamorous druggy parties. I was a bit of a rebel and very shy. When I came across drugs, they gave me the confidence I'd been looking for. That period didn't last long. I went into rehab in 1983, and when I was 23, and I haven't had a drug or drink since. At the time, of course, no one knew about hepatitis C, and like I stated, the virus was discovered in 1989. As many as half of adults infected appear spontaneously to clear themselves of the virus without treatment, according to an American study cited by Professor Miley Vergani, but Serena neither knew that she had it nor that she could pass it on. A few years later, she married a Jamaican and had her son Joshua, now 20, but then in August 1991, Jazzy. When Jazzy was 2, she was ill with bronchitis, so I took her for tests. It was then that I learned that she had hepatitis C, and so did I. I am lucky. Although I have the virus, I have not so far had any of the symptoms. My liver is not badly scarred, and I haven't needed any treatment. I know a lot of people with hepatitis C who have not passed it on to their children, and fortunately my other children are free of it, but somehow I had passed it on to Jazzy, and her liver has already been affected. It is a mother's worst nightmare. My focus since then has been on getting Jazzy well. 4 years later, she left her husband and returned to Britain so her daughter could be treated at King's College Hospital, the world's leading center for pediatric liver disease. In those days, interferon alone was given to boost the immune system. It was horrible for her. I wish I were a mole and could get away from you, she once said as I tried to give her injection. I remember looking at her so out of place for hospital visits in a tutu carrying a fairy wand, but after 2 months, her white cell count had dropped so low that the treatment had to stop. Jazzy picks up the story again from the time when, age 13, she went to boarding school in Bryanston in Dorset. Physically, she felt fine, but she explains liver disease is a silent killer. You don't feel pain until it is so advanced that it's too late to do anything about it. Twice the illness was mentioned in PHSE, which is personal health and social education lessons, the first time in relation to drug use, the second time with reference to sexually transmitted diseases. I remember sitting there feeling so upset, not being able to say anything. Afterwards, I looked on websites and they were terrifying. They said all the bad stuff that would happen, the cancer and the liver failure, and they were so complicated I just couldn't understand them. In her teens, she had further tests on her liver. The news was grim. Jazzy's liver, according to her mother, is that like that of a 55-year-old man who has been drinking and taking drugs for years. I was advised to have further treatment with Mum, knowing how horrible it had been when I was little, wanted to try alternatives. She sent me to Austria, where I had leeches put on my stomach and was wired up to Russian machines. I hated it because all my friends were having fun and I was at this health clinic living on a very strict diet, taking 40 pills and potions a day. Desperate to get rid of the virus, she left Bryanston after GCSEs and, with her great friend Coco Sumner, studied for her A-levels at Hampstead College of Fine Arts so she could attend hospital appointments in London. I was quite freaked out by the idea of taking heavy medical drugs. One evening at home, I was talking about it to Mel Agassi, a documentary maker, who suggested that I make a video diary about the treatment, and I'm glad I did. It gave me something else to think about and a reason to learn more about hepatitis. Although hepatitis C is widespread among drug users, it's easily passed by dirty needles, tattooing, and shared razors. It's relatively rare to contract it in other ways. Hepatitis C and B are both highly infectious through the blood, Professor Miley Vergani says, but B is the one which is more commonly transmitted through sex and vertically from mother to baby. Jazzy has been very unlucky. The chance of passing the C virus through sexual contact is 10 to 20%. From mother to child, the infection rate is only 6%. Yet Jazzy became one of the 200 children under 16 in Britain to be infected. A fifth of the babies clear the virus from their system spontaneously, but Jazzy is not one of them. Nor does she have the rare genotype linked to an 80 to 90% success rate from treatment. It is also unusual that her liver already shown signs of damage during her teens, since it's such a slow-moving disease. Rare as her condition is, liver disease in general is a major killer, causing more deaths than diabetes and road accidents combined. Yet when Jazzy asked the strangers in the street about the liver for the film, she found them shockingly ignorant. Few knew that it is the biggest organ in the body, weighing 2.5 kilograms when filled with blood, nor of its location under the ribs, or even that it filters blood. The liver's ability to regenerate, unique among the body's organs, is well known, but it is not known that scarring is irreversible. Although deaths from liver disease have doubled since 1991, Jazzy found no one knew that the liver needs 48-hour rest from alcohol each week, or that obesity causes damage. Aiming to educate her contemporaries, she started a charity called Liver Good Life, and she had the idea of making an animation to be circulated to schools. Most school science videos are so boring. I wanted this one to be cool. Coco, who has a recording contract, has done the music, and we raised £55,000 to make it. Discussions are now underway with the Department of Health to distribute animation to schools. Jazzy is deliberating over whether or not to make more personal film, My Story of C, widely available, or to turn her 60 hours of footage into a 45-minute version for television. Right now, raising funds has top priority. Coco wanted to hold a party, she said. I said that we should do it in the aid of charity. Now we are doing two, one for adults and another for teenagers. The committee that she has put together is a coruscating lineup of Lennon Smart Set, from Saffron Aldridge to Solange Azuguri Partridge through Bella Freud and Zach Goldsmith and others, Sir Elton John, Rachel Weisz, and Trina Woodall. The 60 names on the list should make for a glitzy evening on September 16th when Christie's has donated the King Street premises for the adult dinner. This was last year, of course, remember this. Liver-friendly food will be provided by Sky Gingle of Peter Shem Nurseries and Giorgio Locatelli. Coco was organizing the music. The aim was to raise £1.5 million to reconstruct the immunology laboratories at the Institute of Liver Studies at King's College and Hospital in London. Despite the leading role played by the Institute in the study of liver disease, and Serena Butte was shocked when she visited their laboratories. They are third world, she says. It's difficult to get support for research into liver disease since there's a widespread view that it's a self-inflicted condition, Professor Miley Vergani says. Nothing could be so wrong. There are devastating genetic or acquired diseases of the liver in both children and adults, which have nothing to do with alcohol consumption or drugs. I see 400 children each year with liver disease, none of whom have inflicted it on themselves. One day, Jazzy DeLisser may find herself snipping the ribbon at the gala opening of a new upbeat-sounding Jazzy Lab, but first, after the parties, she plans to take a well-earned gap year. She is going to New York in September, which has already passed, to do a short film course, and will then be traveling after Christmas, possibly to Africa for some charity work. Her overriding aim, though, is to get well. Ideally, she would like to give her body 3 years to recover from the last treatment, but she is already hoping that Professor Miley Vergani will give her new, more powerful drug treatment sooner. I have promised myself, she says, that I will beat this disease by the time I am 21. Well, let's hope she does. And if you want to know more about her wonderful film, which I actually got to view, you can see parts of it, like I said, uploaded by Media Online on YouTube, and it is well worth your time to sit and watch this girl, hear her words, see how she lives. This is a disease that is clearly going to be affecting us all on some level, and we need to raise awareness. And she's done a stellar job so far, and we can only hope the best for her. And with that comes to the conclusion of Savage Science Radio for this week. Happy trails to all of you for the next week. And I will leave you with the uplifting words of Carl Sagan from the Pale Blue Dot.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on the mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings. How eager they are to kill one another. How fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.